The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you could post your job to 100-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, Buying Time.
The eyes appear to have it. The eyes do have it.
The government avoids another shutdown, at least for a week. Plus, looking back at the Rodney King riots 25 years ago. Later, Foo Fighters frontman Dave Grohl talks to CBS Radio News about life before rock stardom.
I caught the bug for music maybe around 10 or 11 years old.
I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau. We'll get to our interview with Dave later, but first to Congress.
Is there any further debate? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it.
That's the moment the Senate passed a funding bill from the House, avoiding a government shutdown this weekend. It passed a measure that funds the government for another week, while lawmakers work out another broader funding measure. Democrats warned they'd oppose any funding measure if Republicans scheduled a vote this weekend on health care reform. Congress is also preparing to sort through the Trump administration's ambitious tax plan, which includes massive tax breaks. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin.
The president's objective is about tax simplification, and we will be lowering the rate on the high end in return for eliminating almost all deductions. We're committed to keeping charitable deductions and mortgage interest, but everything else is on the table.
The proposal also cuts the corporate tax rate to 15%. President Trump has changed plans to terminate NAFTA. Here's White House correspondent Major Garrett.
Well, I was going to terminate NAFTA as of 2 or 3 days from now.
But President Trump will not pull the U.S. out of the 24-year-old free trade agreement with Canada and Mexico, only try to negotiate a better deal. Mr. Trump spoke with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
I like them very much. I respect their countries very much. The relationship is very special. And I said, I will hold on the termination. Let's see if we can make it a fair deal.
The calls came after the administration floated a draft executive order that would have withdrawn the U.S. from NAFTA immediately. Canada is America's number two trading partner. Mexico is third. Combined, the two account for more than 29% of all U.S. trade.
Do you have a time frame in mind for the NAFTA renegotiation? Any deadline?
It'll start very soon. Thank you.
Renegotiation is a long process that will eventually require congressional approval. Candidate Trump branded NAFTA a failure and made this promise a signature of his campaign.
All I can tell you is that NAFTA is a disaster. What difference does it make? We will fix NAFTA or we'll terminate it and start all over again.
Major Garrett reporting. The White House is shrugging off questions about whether it failed to properly vet ousted National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. It comes as the Pentagon's watchdog begins an investigation into whether Flynn took foreign payments without first getting approval, and as newly released documents from the top Democrat investigating Flynn in Congress raise new concerns. More from our Jeff Pegues.
But we have no evidence, not a shred, that he disclosed his payments.
Elijah Cummings, the top Democrat on the House Oversight Committee, said the documents showed retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn may have broken the law by making a 2015 trip to Moscow, where he was paid nearly $34,000 to speak and was photographed at a dinner with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The first document, a letter from October 2014, was sent from the Defense Intelligence Agency, or DIA, to Flynn shortly before his military retirement. It informed Flynn, who once ran the DIA, that the receipt of consulting fees from a foreign government was prohibited without advance approval.
The Pentagon's warning to General Flynn was bold, italicized, and could not have been clearer.
But the second letter from the DIA to the House committee said it found no record of Flynn seeking permission. In a statement, Flynn's attorney insisted Flynn gave documents to the DIA and briefed the agency both before and after the trip. Flynn has also offered to testify in exchange for immunity, but so far Congress has not called him. Flynn was fired as President Trump's national security advisor after just 24 days for lying to the vice president about his contacts with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. The vice president was also in charge of the Trump transition and would have overseen the vetting of General Flynn. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer brushed off questions about the thoroughness of that process.
But all of that clearance was made by the Obama during the Obama administration, and apparently with knowledge of the trip that he took.
As national security advisor, Flynn had access to the country's most sensitive secrets, which is one reason why Congress is so concerned.
As the Trump administration marks 100 days, White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy is digging into what's next. He spoke with Andrew Bremberg, who's assistant to the president for domestic policy, about health care reform and keeping the government open.
I know that you have spent a great deal of time dealing with the health care
effort.
It seems as though that has gotten stuck, although there are some developments, no doubt. But what one of the reasons it did get stuck was because of the details. I mean, what it really means to the average 64-year-old who makes $26,000 a year and what his or her premium increase is going to be. How do you deal with that, and how do you sell it?
Of course, you know, this is a drawn-out, difficult legislative process, and we have, you know, we've continued to work with the House, and I'm sure you've seen in the news recently, there's a lot of positive messages coming around from all sorts of parts of the Republican Party that we think we've found a, you know, better way forward. We're not there yet. We're working forward, and I think we're going to, you know, fulfill on the president's promise to the American people to actually repeal and replace Obamacare.
Let's dig a little deeper into those developments.
Sure.
This is the whole question about these limited waivers of essential health benefits. Explain that as best you understand it, why it's a good thing, and how hopeful are you that that's going to be the linchpin of this?
The whole concept of the waiver, I think it was a great idea in working with Congress that we were able to work with them to further develop, and it's the idea of helping states waive out of Obamacare. If a state thinks that's the best way for them to drive down health insurance in their state, we want to provide them that flexibility and find a way to, you know, lower costs in their states to get out of the onerous Obamacare rules.
Let's talk about the CR. Are we on track for a deal? I mean, it looks like...
I certainly think so. I certainly hope so. I know the president's committed to keeping the government open and making sure that we, you know, fund the government adequately. I think, you know, we've made that pretty clear, and it's up to the Hill to make sure they pass a bill and send it to the president's desk.
Any lingering issues, any sticking points that are...
I certainly hope not. I'm sure that's an issue that the members of Congress are working on. Now we've got the Democrats fighting amongst themselves over different issues. So I'm confident, though, that we'll keep the government funded.
Andrew Bremberg, thanks a lot, man.
Thank you.
Still to come on the Weekend Roundup.
The president has chosen to work through the Chinese.
Finding a way to control North Korea. That's next on the Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. As tensions simmer on the Korean Peninsula, President Trump tells Reuters South Korea should pay for an expensive missile defense system the U.S. is installing there.
Why are we paying $1 billion? It's a $1 billion system. It's phenomenal. It's the most incredible equipment you've ever seen. It shoots missiles right out of the sky. And it protects them, and I want to protect them. We're going to protect them. But they should pay for that, and they understand that.
CBS News reporter Don Kirk in Seoul says South Korea is working with the U.S. to boost defenses.
U.S. and South Korean defense officials have agreed all measures available are needed to counter North Korean threats. The defense ministry in Seoul says U.S. strategic weapons, including B-52 and B-1 bombers, aircraft carriers, and submarines, will be on regular deployment in or near South Korea.
We've got more with our Stephen Portnoy at the White House, this time talking with Deputy National Security Advisor KT McFarland about her role in reigning in North Korea.
KT, you say that it's a unique role being the Deputy National Security Advisor. It's written into law.
Yeah, Steve, what it is, the Deputy National Security Advisor has a unique role in the government because that's the person who brings together the interagency process. Now, that sounds boring, but what that is State Department, Defense Department, Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Intelligence Community, Treasury Department, Justice Department, Homeland Security. So what we've done in this first 100 days is the president has said a number of areas he wants to concentrate on. The first one was North Korea. So what he said to me was, come up with some options. So I went to all of these agencies and said, what are our options for dealing with North Korea? So they came back with terrific options. Sanctions, yes, but secondary sanctions, pressure we could put on the Chinese, pressure we could do diplomatically with other countries, maybe with our allies, military options, which would be our last resort, obviously, but a number of things that we could present to the president. And then the president has chosen to work through the Chinese and work through our South Korean and Japanese allies to have them do pressure as well as things that we're doing. And when he met with the Chinese president in Mar-a-Lago at the first summit between China and the United States, the two leaders, the two presidents, spent a lot of time together. It was interesting. They were supposed to spend sort of 10 minutes one-on-one and then have a bigger meeting with their ministers and cabinet officials. But the two presidents were making real progress. So they talked for 2 hours while the cabinet ministers all stood in the hallway while the two presidents started talking about why is North Korea a problem? How could our relationship evolve to a better relationship? How can you help us? How can we help you? And as a result, the Chinese have in the last 3 weeks, we think, played, you know, preliminary. We're tentative, but we're starting to see some changes.
This is a different approach to this particular question. I mean, the United States has been dealing with this issue for more than 20 years.
Absolutely.
And not going in the right direction.
Not successfully.
So, but really what the people need to know is that this is, and what the North Koreans need to know, mm-hmm. is that Washington is beginning to think about this very differently.
You know, the Clinton administration failed to stop the nuclear program. The Bush administration failed to stop it. The Obama administration failed to stop it. And when President Obama left office, the message he had for President Trump is your biggest problem, your most immediate problem, is going to be nuclear weapons in North Korea. So that's why the president turned to this right away. And he understands you've got to deal with it now. He's given messages loud and clear to the North Koreans, loud and clear to the Chinese, loud and clear to our allies, South Korea and Japan, that we are now dealing with this issue. And I've been in the national security world for a long time, and I have been so impressed by the way President Trump has approached this with a different kind of thinking. You know, not going to kick the can down the road any further. We're going to deal with it now. And so far, preliminarily, we're seeing some positive results.
KT McFarland, Deputy National Security Advisor, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The Pentagon has identified the two U.S. servicemen killed in Afghanistan Thursday as 22-year-old Sergeant Joshua Rogers from Bloomington, Illinois, and 23-year-old Sergeant Cameron Thomas from Kettering, Ohio. Correspondent Kimmy McCormick has more from the Pentagon.
These two Army Rangers died during an operation in Nangarhar Province. This is where another U.S. service member was killed earlier this month. U.S. and Afghan troops have been trying to stop the growth of Islamic State in Afghanistan, and the U.S. dropped a massive bomb in this area. Defense Secretary James Mattis just returned from Afghanistan and is reviewing the strategy there. The Taliban has also been making gains on the battlefield.
British police say they foiled two different terror plots in one day. Larry Miller has the story from London.
A woman is in serious condition after being shot by anti-terrorist police during a raid on a house in northwest London. Tear gas firing police smashed in the door. There were six arrests. Scotland Yard's Neil Basu says police broke up an active terrorist plot.
Due to these arrests that have been made yesterday, I believe we have contained the threats that they posed.
Police say there's no connection between this alleged plot and an earlier arrest near Downing Street of a man carrying knives. He's also suspected of planning a terrorist attack. Larry Miller, CBS News. News, London.
It's a surprising find in an unlikely place. Correspondent Charlie Daggett has more from England.
One historian called it the discovery of a lifetime, a priceless handwritten parchment of the Declaration of Independence, beyond rare. The only one like it is the 1776 copy kept under the glass at the National Archives in Washington.
We certainly weren't looking for a copy of the declaration like this.
Harvard researchers Emily Sneff and Professor Danielle Allen came upon it while searching the globe for every known copy of the declaration.
Nobody even had an inkling that a second one might exist, and so therefore there was no reason to look for such a thing.
They believe it was penned in America in the 1780s, probably commissioned by James Wilson.
I'll be the man who prevented American independence.
Portrayed as a flip-flopper in the movie 1776, but a fervent nationalist. And there is a difference in this copy that drills down into the very foundation of the nation. The signatures are in no particular order, rather than listed by state, as in the 1776 copy.
It goes to the heart of the American political order. Does the American political order rest on a single national people or on treaties among several states?
The researchers believe the document originally belonged to the Duke of Richmond, known as the Radical Duke, for the support he gave to American revolutionaries. It was handed down over generations of dukes until a local man handed it into the records office in the 1950s.
Is this going to stay here?
Yes.
You're not going to give it up?
No.
County archivist Wendy Walker makes no excuse for sitting on it for 60 years.
We did know we had it, but as I say, it hadn't had the academic interest and research done on it to bring out any of the detail.
Considering its historical magnitude, it hadn't been treated well. It had even been folded into a small square. But for Emily Sneff, it was a thing of beauty.
So being able to go to West Essex and hold this parchment in our hands to look at it closely was just extraordinary.
Charlie Daggett of reporting, the British National Museum is due to begin tests on it to verify its authenticity. Up next,
we were getting a little over three new fires a minute.
Remembering the Rodney King riots 25 years ago on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Check out CBS Radio News podcasts. From hard news to features, there's lots available from our app. Listen to experts like John Dickerson each Sunday on Face the Nation or Scott Pelley every weeknight on the CBS Evening News. There's the World News Roundup, America's longest-running network newscast, and the Weekend Roundup, our weekend review magazine show. It's all available from CBSRadioNews.com or on our app for iOS and Android.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. A spring frost could put a major dent in French wine production. CBS News correspondent Eileen Cobb has more from Paris.
The vineyards in Burgundy are glowing at night as winemakers use flaming torches to keep their grapes from freezing during an unusually cold snap. Elsewhere, they're using heaters and fans. Some have even resorted to using the downdraft from helicopters to heat the crops. Temperatures in Burgundy, Bordeaux and Champagne plummeted to well below zero this week, prompting fears the frost could kill spring shoots. A cold snap last spring was partly to blame for a 10% drop in wine output across France. Elaine Cobb, CBS News, Paris.
This weekend marks the 25th anniversary of some of the worst civil unrest in American history, scarring many communities throughout L.A. Our Steve Futterman is there looking back.
This is how it began.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Lawrence M. Powell, not guilty of the crime of assault.
Los Angeles police officers found not guilty in the beating of Rodney King. Outside the courthouse, there was immediate outrage.
Guilty! Guilty!
And soon after, the unrest spread to the streets of L.A. For 6 days, the looting, the destruction, and the fires continued.
From midnight to about 3 o'clock, we were getting a little over three new fires a minute.
Why are you taking the merchandise?
'Cause fun.
It's fun?
Yeah.
Even news crews were not safe. Reporter Bob Brill was attacked as he filed a report.
Now I see smoke. Something can't tell.
Oh, God! No!
At one point, Rodney King made a personal appeal for the violence to stop.
Can we all get along? Can we get along?
A quarter century later, people still remember this man was a teenager in 1992. He is now in his 40s.
I'm not going to incriminate myself. I definitely did not loot, though. What it excited me was, you know, the anarchy. That's what excited me. So
did you throw a rock?
I'm not going to say I did or I didn't. Okay. But you know, I did, you know, express myself. That's for sure.
Not far from where some of the violence took place, at the California African American Museum here in Los Angeles, a special exhibit about 1992 is currently being presented.
So welcome to No Justice, No Peace, LA 1992.
Tyree Boyd Pates is the curator. He put the exhibit together. What does he think we can learn about the events from 1992?
Lessons from 92. I think that's a very individualistic question. And I have gotten a myriad of responses from people, from tears to me having to console them, to utter like pride in the fact that we've moved forward from this.
In the end, more than 50 people were killed. There was more than $1 billion worth of property damage. Most generally agree improvements have taken place. Still, some feel this could happen again.
I feel like the system has not changed.
Steve Futterman, CBS News, Los Angeles.
Apple has taken charge to improve the experience of its customers at its stores, and it's being led by the company's highest-ranking female executive. She talked with CBS This Morning anchor Nora O'Donnell.
It was in 2001 that the world got its first look inside an Apple store.
We're so excited about this.
But now the look and the feel of the stores is changing, thanks to Angela Ahrens.
We have a screen like this in 100 stores.
Senior Vice President of Apple Retail. In 100 of its biggest stores, like this San Francisco flagship, Apple's hardware update means new screens and spaces for meetings and classes. The Genius Bar, now lined with trees, becomes the Genius Grove. And there's a more dimensional take on the Genius. New staffers specialized in music and photography called Creative Pros.
Look at my face!
Is the idea that the store will have all of these listed classes, teachers, experiences that will be publicly posted that will draw more and more people in?
Absolutely. So we call the software of the store that we're launching the end of May, we call that Today at Apple.
Ahrens calls it an effort to create town squares where customers engage with their devices and their communities.
A lot of the big online guys have said they're opening stores. Amazon's investing in stores, Google's investing in stores, and, you know, and I've told the teams, I'll know we've done a really, really great job if the next generation of Gen Z says, meet me at Apple.
Can you foster a sense of community at the same time having a commercial objective?
I think we've always been this energy hub, if you will. We're just empowering the teams to take it so much further.
Sales of iPhones and Mac computers have been strong in 2017, but there was a little bit of a dip in 2016. And some people speculated, well, Apple's at the end of its product line, and the store redesign is just window dressing. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I'd respond they probably don't really know the company that well. Tim talks a lot during the earnings calls on the service business and how rapidly that's growing. And, you know, and that's the part, really, we had never been able to unlock in retail before.
It was at Burberry that Ahrens first merged retail with online shopping, tripling company stock and prompting Tim Cook to call London from Cupertino.
I told Tim this as we were interviewing. I said, I am not a techie. Wrong person. He, you know, very politely said, I think we have a lot of those. And
so why did he want you if you're not a techie?
I think what it came down to, honestly, because the teams are so big and so global, I think that a lot of it had to do with leadership.
I read that part of the reason that he hired you was because of your ability to motivate people. How do you motivate people?
You don't overthink it, right? Do unto others. I mean, you connect with them and you care and you do what you say you're going to do. I mean, it's not rocket science.
Ahrens says it's her Midwestern upbringing as one of six children raised in New Palestine, Indiana, that keeps her humble, even as she's become one of the highest paid executives at Apple and in the country.
Steve Jobs was famously empathetic. I've heard you say empathy is one of the greatest creators of energy. What role has it played in your success?
I mean, again, I think huge. You know, my dad used to always say, I can teach you anything, but I can't teach you to feel. I can't teach you to care. And I think when you're empathetic, you're putting yourself in somebody else's shoes. It's not about you. There's 7 billion people on the planet. It's not about you. I think that when you're empathetic to someone, they open up to you, right? They don't get defensive. And when they open up, you're both open, and then you can dream and you can, you know, come up with incredible things together. And
it unlocks a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, Foo Fighters frontman opens up to CBS Radio News about life before being a rock star.
I tried at school, I guess. It just didn't really take.
Please follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. A settlement was announced Thursday between the man dragged from that United flight in that video we all saw in the airline.
Dr. David Dow was dragged from United Flight 3411 on April 9th. Now, 18 days later, United is settling with him after a resulting public relations nightmare. Airline President Oscar Munoz promised reforms in a video posted to the company website.
He deeply apologized for what happened. I apologize. Though sorry simply doesn't go nearly far enough to address the shocking way one of our passengers was treated that day and for our response that followed.
Terms of the settlement have not been disclosed. Bill Rakoff, CBS News.
American Airlines faced its own public scrutiny after video surfaced of a sobbing woman whose baby was almost hit by a stroller as an airline employee got into a shouting match with another passenger. More from transportation correspondent Chris Van Cleve.
The latest viral video is another black eye for the airline industry. Already under the microscope for how it treats customers after the violent removal of a passenger from a United flight earlier this month.
Oh my God, look at what you did to him!
It's making our jobs harder. It's potentially pitting passengers against crew members before they even get to the plane together.
Sarah Nelson is the president of the Association of Flight Attendants, a union representing 50,000 employees at 20 airlines, including United.
Flight attendants are trained to de-escalate conflict every single day, and actually that has become a big part of our job.
Airline analyst Henry Hartevelt says many passengers now feel they're leaving their humanity behind when they get on fuller planes with seats that seem to get smaller all the time.
At the same time, airlines are staffing their planes with the minimum number of required flight attendants, and that's not right for the passenger or for the employee either.
The FAA says there are nearly 24,000 commercial flights a day. Almost all take off and land without an issue. The number of unruly passengers hit an all-time low last year. But in the age of the smartphone, a mistake or bad day can be seen around the world in minutes. American Airlines is getting praised for its swift response, apologizing, grounding that flight attendant, and launching an investigation.
Chris Van Cleve reporting, now raising a rock star and talking with his mom.
I'm Steve Kaith in CBS News with Dave Grohl of the Foo Fighters and his mom, Virginia. She's written a book, From Cradle to Stage, Stories from the Mothers Who Rocked and Raised Rock Stars. You raised one, Virginia.
I did.
What was it like? I mean, I guess there are key moments along the way that you have to deal with.
There are some problems, I guess. But the final chapter is really great. We've had a wonderful time.
Yeah.
I suppose the biggest conflicts came with school. It was very uncomfortable. It was not his favorite place to be. And I was a teacher. He was committed to music and didn't love going to classes every day.
So, Dave, as interest in music grows, school, lessons.
I tried at school, I guess. It just didn't really take. I was learning multiple instruments, and I was learning how to play and how to write and how to sing, and I was releasing records with my band independently when I was 14 or 15 years old, and I was putting on concerts at that age, but I just didn't really have much interest in school.
But Virginia, you have to deal with, I guess, the question or the issue, I want to drop out or I want to leave it behind. Not just less interest in it, but it's gone for me. I just want to go in a different direction. How do you cope with that?
Well, in our case, that seemed the most logical and the best solution to the problem of wasting time. And, you know, the teachers of all of these rock stars that I talked to complained endlessly about their lack of focus and their inability to pay attention to what was But they were so completely focused on the music and on composing and playing and sharing the music and so on that that's had to be the direction. So that was it.
Virginia, you spoke to the moms of other stars, Pharrell Williams, Kelly Clarkson. Did you find their stories were similar? Were there differences? I mean, did you find a common thread?
There were some common threads. There were, of course, differences. And with the different types of music, there were things that played out differently. But mainly the thing I found that surprised me and that was really consistent was the age at which they all said, I will be a musician. That's it. And that was early, 12 to 13, they all knew. The thing is, also, we'd never talked about making it in the business. David never said, I want to be a rock star. He never said, and I don't think any of these people said, I want to be rich and famous. As you might hear today, that was never part of the future. Mm. It was, I want to be a musician.
Dave, did you have a backup plan or no?
The furniture warehouse that I was working in, Marlowe's Furniture Warehouse. No, you know, I looked at it like, and I still look at it the same way, the happiest musicians aren't necessarily the ones that are rich and famous and hugely successful. They're the ones that are playing. So the way I looked at it was, well, I had my job that I'd work, and then at night I'd go play music, and then when it was time to hit the road, I'd say to my boss, hey, I got to split for 2 months. When I come back, can I have my job back? And I was okay with that. It was all right.
Doing what you love. That's what Dave Grohl is doing. And Virginia Grohl, his mother, has written the book From Cradle to Stage, Stories from the Mothers Who Rocked and Raised Rock Stars. I'm Steve Kathan, CBS News.
The sharing economy turns to weddings.
On a day when a bride needs something old, something new, something borrowed, and something blue, a new startup is offering all of the above at a discount. Bloomerant, an online marketplace, pairs up people willing to share centerpiece arrangements to save a few bucks.
They're beautiful.
The first bride picks out her flowers and gets a 10% discount for sharing them with a second bride. That second bride saves 40 to 60% by using those same flowers a day or two later. This bride paid just $850 for the same flowers that cost the first bride $1,700.
Do you still remember your wedding flowers?
They were roses, hydrangeas, this beautiful cream white color, and they were very expensive.
After seeing those perfectly fresh flowers tossed at the end of her wedding, Denise Zamir came up with the idea for Bloomerant. Julia Capolino is her partner.
We share our cars, we share our clothing, we even share our beds, Airbnb. So why not your, you know, event flowers?
Kia Miner is editor-in-chief of Brides Magazine.
When you first heard about this idea, what did you think?
At first, I thought, I don't know if every bride is going to love the idea of sharing flowers. But I quickly realized for some people, it is not one of their biggest priorities.
And for those wedding guests hoping to go home with a centerpiece in hand.
I come from a family where they'll leave an hour early to make sure that they leave with the centerpieces.
When I got married, I know my mom was saying, well, Aunt Betty's getting this centerpiece and Aunt Evelyn's getting this one, so.
But if you knew you were going to save $2,000 because the florist was picking up your centerpieces, I think you might have said, Aunt Betty, I'll buy you some roses.
Meg Oliver, CBS News, New York.
Coming up, writing the president.
My name is Cesar Vargas.
I'm Leo Smith.
Dear Mr. President.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
CBS Radio News, the original radio news network, is now on Amazon Alexa. Amazon Alexa. Whether you have the Amazon Echo, Amazon Tap, or Echo Dot, you can listen to our newscasts just by setting CBS Radio News to your flash briefing.
Here's your flash briefing.
Or just ask for CBS News and hear our 24/7 stream through our partners at TuneIn.
This is CBS Radio News on TuneIn.
Wherever you want to listen, CBS Radio News is there.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Expect more delays at Penn Station in New York.
Amtrak CEO Wick Moorman said they will do track replacement and signal work Monday through Friday this summer through September, and weekend work will continue beyond that. but he could not say how many tracks will be closed at any given time or what the delays would be like for riders.
Our target is the minimum number of tracks to be impacted while getting this work done.
He says the recent derailments at the nation's busiest rail station show that Amtrak must step up its game and stop patching, repairing, and hoping they don't have another crisis. Marla Diamond, CBS News, New York.
Correspondent Peter King reports from Orlando on delays facing a different transportation system.
The Space Launch System rocket and Orion spacecraft are supposed to fly an unmanned mission around the moon in November 2018, but a General Accounting Office report says technical problems will probably delay that into the next year. The main problem is a delay with the Orion service module, which contains life support in the ship's engines. There's no wiggle room in the schedule for setbacks, so any delay means they won't meet the planned launch date. The report says the project is making progress overall, but again calls a November 2018 launch highly unlikely. Peter King, CBS News, Orlando.
Tennis star Serena Williams opened up to CBS This Morning anchor Gail King at TED Talk in Vancouver about her newly revealed pregnancy and the man she's planning to marry. More from correspondent Dana Jacobson.
Have you thought, am I coming back? Will I take some time off?
Well, I'm always trying to defy the odds, you know. So for me, everything is really mental. And I definitely plan on coming back. I'm not done yet.
Even at 35 years old and with a baby on the way, Serena Williams is confident her time on the tennis court is far from over. But her time as a mother is about to begin.
This is just a new part of my life.
Yeah.
And my baby's going to be in the stands and hopefully cheering for me and not crying too much.
Williams says she accidentally shared the pregnancy news on Snapchat last week. The future Hall of Famer found out she was expecting only 2 days before the Australian Open in January, telling Gail King, "I was nervous. I wasn't sure what to do. Can I play?" Williams played and Williams won, beating her sister Venus while nearly 2 months pregnant, capturing a record-setting 23rd Grand Slam title.
You've had three life-changing things in a six-month time.
Williams also opened up to Gail about her love life. She's engaged to investor and Reddit founder Alexis Ohanian.
You saw, I met a guy. He's a nerdy, kind of geeky guy. You won't know who he is. I said,
I remember talking to you about that.
Yes, what's his name? And you said Alexis Ohanian. I go, I know him.
Yes.
He's awesome.
Yeah,
he's. But I would have never put you with a nerdy geek. And you
me
said
neither.
You
I'm going to be honest with you. I didn't either, but it's been the best thing for me.
100 days of the Trump administration in the voices of voters. In a project for CBS News, asking Americans across the country to write letters to President Trump.
Dear President Trump, my name is Stephen Shook.
My name is Cesar Vargas.
And Leo Smith.
Dear Mr. President, my name is Hallie Mitchenscook. I'm a 26-year-old resident of Struthers, Ohio, and I did not vote for you in the election. I grew up in a small blue-collar community, most of whom you appeal to in your campaign. Even though I wasn't drawn into your rhetoric, I would like to ask on behalf of all those who were, why haven't any of your political promises been fulfilled in your first 100 days as president?
I'm a businessman and an activist with the Georgia Republican Party, and I voted for you.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
I still believe. At the top of my list during the 2016 election was the need for a candidate who would disrupt the status quo. Judging by the number of political pundits and foreign heads of state complaining about your lack of predictability and your colorful Twitter feed, I'd say we woke people up.
In dealing with global issues in Syria, North Korea, and Afghanistan, you have used and shown necessary force, and in doing so, you have shown the world that the United States now has a real commander-in-chief.
I completely agree with the action that you took to show the Syrian government that the United States will not sit idly by while they torture and kill innocent people. It does make a person wonder, though. If you truly cared about the suffering of Syrian children, why have you banned them from the safety of our country?
Dear President Trump, I'm an attorney from Staten Island, New York, and if I could vote, I would not vote for you. You said you had a great heart and you wouldn't deport dreamers like me. And yet, the nation is seeing the rise of a deportation force that is creating a climate of fear and deporting dreamers and good people.
You have deported criminals who are living here illegally. Again, you have shown our country and the world that America and our safety come first.
I have children tell me they are afraid to go to school. Even some U.S.-born Latinos in my community feel they now have to carry their American passport just in case they come in contact with immigration.
Pre-Trump, my 9-year-old son, Luke, had an aspirant life vision, but his vision was only matched by his occasional distress about the state of his future as an American. Your attention is needed in addressing schools where English-speaking students have subject time curtailed by the reality that many of their classmates cannot understand classes taught in English. We do embrace legal immigration, but not at the expense of academic progress.
As an educator, I am very concerned about your appointment of Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education.
I was just asking to clarify.
As a teacher in a low-income district, I am very worried that free and reduced school lunches may be cut. I have seen students digging through trash cans looking for something to eat when not in school.
My only disappointment in your first 100 days of your presidency was the proposed health care reform.
We're going to be living with Obamacare for the foreseeable future.
As a young entrepreneur, and as someone who has specialized healthcare needs due to undergoing brain surgery 8 years ago, the current cost of healthcare is extremely unaffordable for myself and for many other Americans.
Being the president is about trust. With all your proven lies, how can you expect to be trusted?
You get an A for stimulating market confidence, sir, but we need lower and middle class jobs.
I know that you have faced a tremendous amount of opposition from people and by media outlets. My advice to you, for whatever it's worth, stay humble, Mr. President, even in the face of opposition.
I want you to succeed, but only if you bring out the best of this nation, not the worst.
I hope that at the end of your 4 years, I can be proud of what you achieved and worked towards.
Your first 100 days has been a reshaping of American vision, and we thank you for it. We're now more interested in the engine of the car and not the flamboyance of the driver. So, sir, please just deliver the pizza. Americans are hungry.
Analysis of the president's job from the people who really matter. Everyday Americans for CBS News. We appreciate you listening to the Weekend Roundup. We want to get your feedback. Send us your love letters, recipes, DIY tips, whatever, to weekendroundup@cbsnews.com. You can do an online search to find past episodes. Search for CBS News Weekend Roundup. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Dory Valerio helps out in New York. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.